This is Dr. Jay Corsandi, and you're listening to The Best Night Ever, the show that's dedicated to helping you get your best night's sleep. Over the last 20 years of treating patients, I've worn many hats, including dentist, engineer, psychologist, artist, corporate executive, and more. I've found that the key to success, health, and longevity lies in sleep, and that's why I created this show. I want to teach you how to make sleep your best friend. Join me on a journey to uncover cutting-edge science, life-changing tips from renowned experts, ancient and modern sleep secrets, game-changing routines, and lifestyle hacks that will educate, inspire, and ultimately help you get the best night ever. Hey everyone, you might need a helmet for this episode because you're about to get your minds blown by my special guest and my special show format today. I'm going to try something a little different for this show, and instead of the typical one-directional interview where I ask a bunch of questions, I've teamed up with another health and wellness podcaster, and we're going to do a doubleheader. In this episode, I'm speaking with Kayla Osterhoff. Kayla has her own podcast called the BioCurious Podcast, and we thought it'd be fun to interview each other about all the things we've learned in our own journeys to health. You're going to want to listen to Kayla as she's a health scientist, researcher, professional biohacker, nationally ranked athlete, and integrative mind-body medicine coach. In this episode, we're going to discuss our own morning and night routines, the definition of this term biohacking, some of the best tips and takeaways from our guests that we've had on our own shows, what to do if you're just starting your journey into health and wellness, the coronavirus and how to navigate your life accordingly, EMF concerns and what to think about when you hear 5G, the power of mindset and the nocebo effect, and a whole lot more. And as always, if you want to learn more about me, you can follow me on Instagram on my account there. It's called Sleep Biohacker. And I also encourage you to check out the BioCurious podcast as well. And now, on to the show.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for getting up at the crack of dawn on the West Coast to hang out with me on Zoom for this, what I think will be a really cool episode of both of our podcasts. If you guys don't already know, you know the BioCurious podcast, of course, but Jay has an awesome podcast. It's called The Best Night Ever, and it's all about different biohacking methods, but also specifically focused on getting really good quality sleep.
Yeah, Kayla, thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to do this as well, kind of a two-for-one special.
Yeah, it's going to be fun because we are both super nerdy about biohacking our sleep. And so I cannot wait to compare notes from what I know about Jay. He is a master biohacker and has all of the cool tools. I think of myself as a little bit more of a boring biohacker because I go for mostly like the natural free biohacks instead of the like expensive tricks and tools. But that stuff is super exciting too.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, fortunately for where I'm at, what I'm doing, I get access to a lot of cool tech and gadgets. But, you know, I always tell people some of the best biohacks and performance upgrades can be free or very, very cheap. So you don't have to have all the fancy toys. You can do stuff that's very simple. And we can talk about that in the show as well.
Cool. Yeah, I definitely want to pick your brain on some of the tech that you use specifically for sleep, just because I have not tried a lot of them. But yeah, let's start with, why don't we just kind of go back and forth with our top sleep biohacks, like the most profound things that have helped us to sleep the best. And you can start.
Sure. So, I mean, I always tell people your best night's sleep starts the morning you wake up. And really what you want to do is focus on everything you could do throughout the day to kind of help you fall asleep and stay asleep that night, you know. And simple things are going to be, this is a big one in the whole, you know, sleep and biohacking world, is, you know, catching a sunrise if you can, where you're going to get the melanin buildup for your skin for sun UV resistance and during the day. And then you're also going to get melatonin activation into your pineal gland, which will be pulled up and reserved for night as well. So sunrise is going to be an easy one. I always recommend a simple, you know, 20, 30 minute walk during lunchtime just to get some midday sun exposure for some vitamin D and some circadian entrainment. And then by nighttime, you know, you want to stay away from blue light, cell phones, things like that. I always also recommend eating around sunset or 2 hours before bed, just because if you start to eat later at night, that's going to disrupt melatonin release. And then there's an antagonistic relationship between insulin and melatonin. I don't know, are you aware of this one?
Yeah, actually, I was just reading a really cool research paper. I have to see if I can dig it up for the show notes in one of my biochemistry classes, actually. And they were talking about how insulin and kind of the whole glucose metabolism can really mess up your various hormones, but especially melatonin.
Yeah, so again, the name of the game in longevity and anti-aging, one of the biggest things is watching insulin levels and glucose levels just in general, but particularly at night, it's going to make a big difference on your sleep. So I always say don't eat too late. You're better off eating some junk food in the day than something really healthy late at night.
Yeah, I agree with that. However, a lot of times I'll eat my more carby meal. I don't eat that many carbs in general. I eat a pretty low carb diet. Mm-hmm. However, I usually do eat most of my carbs at night, and that actually makes me feel a little more relaxed and does help me fall asleep.
Yeah, I tend to do that as well. I tend to stick kind of more to a higher fat diet throughout the day, and then I'll have more of kind of a carby dinner as well too. So I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, but maybe we're doing it wrong based on this new research coming out about insulin.
There's always different research out there. Yeah, that's the thing. Things are always changing, and people need to understand that as well too, that if you hear a certain trick or tip or biohack or new research article, take it a little bit with a grain of salt, because, you know, I would say try it. If it helps you, great, keep doing it. But there's always new things that are going to be coming out that might be better for you or might help you differently.
Yeah, totally. I think people like to hop on the bandwagon, especially when it comes to like intermittent fasting and different diets. Like the keto diet is like super popular right now. And I roll my eyes a little bit, not because it's a bad diet or a bad practice, because I do use both of those things. Mm-hmm. However, it's exactly what you're saying. Everyone is so individual, and especially women are a lot more complicated, because not only are we, like men, on a 24-hour circadian rhythm cycle, a 24-hour hormone cycle, but women are also on a 28 to 30 plus day cycle of hormones. Mm-hmm. And so there are times throughout the hormone cycle of a woman throughout the month where it's not going to be really beneficial to do like a long-term fast or do intermittent fasting or do really high fat. It can actually really interact poorly with your hormones. So even for women, we're kind of different people throughout the month. And so we have to be cognizant of that when we're making our biohacking choices, because whatever you do every day is not going to work for you every day of the month. Whereas a man can probably get away with intermittent fasting every day, doing keto, and a lot of them will do really well that way.
You know, I sometimes have my little moments throughout the month as well too. So maybe there is a little bit of a menstrual cycle, but who knows?
I think if your partner is a woman and she has a menstrual cycle, I think for sure it's a thing.
Yeah. So let's go through some of the hacks that you think are beneficial for your sleep that you've done.
Yeah. So just basic baseline things that I always do. You mentioned a lot of them. So getting sun exposure during the day on my bare skin without like sunblock or clothes covering. I basically stopped wearing sunglasses about 2 or 3 years ago. I do wear it when I'm on the West Coast, especially my hometown of Reno, where it's like the sun is just so bright, it feels like it's burning your eyeballs. But out here on the East Coast, the sun is not super intense, and so I really don't need sunglasses. And I've actually noticed an improvement in my eyesight, and maybe it's placebo, I don't know. But I do like to get sun into my eyes. And then getting exercise during the day, but not too late at night, because I don't want to spike cortisol, you know, within a few hours of bedtime. Blue blockers at night once it gets dark, because like you and most people listening, we are on our screens until very late. And then sleeping in a cold, dark room is really important for me. And then no food after the sun goes down, if I can help it. And the other one is one supplement that has really, really helped my sleep the most is magnesium threonate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, for people listening, people are always asking me, what should I do or take at night that's going to help us sleep? Magnesium is a big one. I mean, I've been listening to a bunch of podcasts lately about magnesium. It tends to be kind of the quiet supplement. A lot of people aren't aware of it. It's involved in, you know, 3,000 plus enzymatic reactions in the body. So we tend to be deficient on it. I mean, the big thing was vitamin D maybe a couple of years ago. And now I think magnesium is making a big push. So I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, I think both vitamin D and magnesium are really, really essential and important to make sure that your levels are good. So whether you're actually getting lab tests done to check those levels, or if you're just kind of going by what you feel, but we typically, especially in the US with our degraded food system and soil, unfortunately, we're not getting a lot of these basic baseline supplements that we need. And vitamin D is an easy one because you can get it from going outside. But that being said, a lot of us don't spend enough time outside to get those levels to where we need them to be.
Yeah. So this is something I wanted to ask you, and I've thrown this word around a lot on my show. Some people understand it, some people don't. We've talked about it a little bit before, is this word biohacking. If you're in that kind of genre or industry, you know what it means. But for people who don't know, what would be your definition of biohacking?
Yeah, so we're basically all biohackers, whether we know it or not. I was definitely a biohacker long before I even heard or knew what the term was. But essentially what it is any person changing their environment. So whether that be their external environment, meaning, you know, their home, what they use in their home as far as products and like cleaning supplies, or what kind of food they put in their home, or music that they listen to in their home or whatever. And then their internal environment, which can be, you know, the gut, the brain, your biochemistry that's happening. So it's basically changing something in one of those environments or both of those environments so that you can have control over your biology for a specific outcome that you're hoping to have.
Okay, I'll take that one.
Yeah. What would be your definition? I mean, you're well-versed in the biohacking world.
So lately, I've been thinking about kind of reversely. I think we're all fundamentally reverse biohackers. And the difference only being is awareness. Meaning, like when I was a kid growing up, I would have cereal in the morning with milk, regular, you know, cow milk, regular cereal.
Me too.
And, you know, I would go to school, I'd ride the bus. And when I'm coming home every day, I remember having these nasty stomach aches. And I never knew what was going on. I just thought that's just how it is. I'd get home, I'd go and throw a Hot Pocket in the microwave, and I would eat that and chips and all these things. And you never know. And then even all the way up to when I was in postgraduate school, I'm having deep dish pizzas in Chicago. And I'm always like slowing down and suffering and hurting, but we just never really paid attention to it. So I think the essence of biohacking is just almost doing the opposite of what you were doing if it was hurting you, and then paying attention to how you feel about it. And then you go, oh my God, things are better.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because I actually, just like you, didn't realize how crappy I felt every day until I felt good. And then it was like, whoa, this is a lot different. And I don't want to go back to feeling crappy again, because that is terrible. So like even just making small tweaks in food was the biggest thing for me. Maybe like 12 years ago, I started running. Before then, I was not a runner at all. And when I started running, I was working in physical therapy at the time, and all of my colleagues were big runners, and they all ate the paleo diet. And so that was my like first introduction to changing my diet, and basically cutting out processed food was the biggest thing, and especially like processed sugar. And it made all the difference in how I felt, because I was eating a lot of those refined foods that you mentioned, like cereal. And for me, after school, it was cup of noodles, and I would eat like two or three of those.
Oh man.
Yeah, it was bad.
So yeah, I got another question for you here too. So we're both, you know, you have the BioCurious Kayla podcast. I've got the Best Night Ever podcast. Both of us have had some pretty big industry leaders on the show. And obviously, one of the benefits of doing this podcast, I think you can agree, is that we all learn something from the guests that we have on the show. Mm. So what would be a couple of your best tips or takeaways from the people you've had on the show that have had like the most impact on what you've done or what you've learned?
Yeah. So one really interesting thing is when I started the podcast, I knew that I would have a lot of experts from various fields and high performers and different areas of health and wellness on the podcast. But, and this is maybe the research scientist in me, I wanted to have a single input that was something I collected that was the same from everyone so that I could compare and see if there are similarities or like, you know, if all these people are kind of doing or thinking the same thing that make them high performance people. So as you know, and maybe we'll talk about this today, I like to ask all my podcast guests one thing, which is, do they have a morning routine and what does that include? Because I want to know, how do people set themselves up for success in the morning? And is it typically the same across all high performers? And I'm actually always shocked because there has not been the same answer once. Maybe there's like one or two or no things that are the same within each person's morning routine, but they're all so different. And that goes back to the whole each person is unique aspect, is that whatever sets you personally up for success is what you have to do. Like if you copied my morning routine, it probably wouldn't work for you. But like when we got on the call today, Jay, you said that you were having your bulletproof coffee and getting kind of settled in at your desk. And I'm sure that's part of your morning routine. And everybody is so different. So I was actually surprised and learned a lot just from that fact.
Okay. So the morning routines. And I think that was actually one of the questions I was going to ask you as well too. One of the things that I do on the show is I've been asking people, what's your night routine? Just because I kind of want to see how people wind down for the end of the day as well too. So we can do morning or night routines, you know.
Yeah.
I'm game for whatever.
Definitely. Let's do it.
All right. So what's your morning routine?
So my morning routine, I would be lying if I said I had a solid morning routine every single day. So some of my listeners probably know, but your listeners are probably new to me. So I actually just retired from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Friday. So that is new for me. But before then, I was working full-time as a health scientist there, as well as full-time as a doctoral student. And I have my podcast and my BioCurious coaching business and all of that stuff. So I was not very good with any of my routines, morning or night. But I'll tell you what the best case scenario is. So best case, and I'm starting to reinvent this now that I find myself with more time on my plate, is waking up slow is really important. I like to wake up without an alarm. And my body, for whatever reason, like if I sleep a good night's sleep, I naturally wake up at about 8 a.m. Before then, I will not naturally wake up. I can with an alarm, but if I just let myself naturally wake up, I would prefer to wake up around 8 a.m. And then once I open my eyes, you know, just get out of bed instead of trying to snooze or anything. And then I like to just take a few deep, slow breaths. And the first thing I do is after I sit up, I take a few breaths, kind of come into my body. I walk over to my window, open up my blackout curtains, let the sun shine in. I have a little balcony. Sometimes I'll step outside and I have a full, I think it's like 32 ounce water bottle. That's usually still pretty full in the morning. So I basically just chug that entire thing. And then I kind of soak up the sun for a few minutes. And then I'll do a little meditation session using my Waking Up app from Tim Harris. I don't know if you know of that app, but it's my favorite meditation app. So it's just usually 10 or 15 minutes. And then I'll get into a really hot shower followed by a really cold shower. So I like the heat to as kind of like a relaxing, calming shower to start. And then I do a little blast of cold at the end for some energy. And then I come downstairs and I make my bulletproof coffee. And then I usually, at that point, I may read for a few minutes if I have time, or do a little session of listening to some binaural beats. And then I will hop on, turn on my phone and get the day started with email and everything.
Wow, that sounds like a luxurious morning. My challenge with that is your morning routine may depend on your point or situation in life. For me, it's different because I'm married and have two little kids. So my mornings could be, my kids running into the room, jumping on the bed, waking me up, slapping me in the face, cartoons, making breakfast. So it could be crazy, but in an ideal situation for me, I try to take a minimalistic approach to mornings as well, where I'll leave my phone in airplane mode right when I go to bed at night, all the way through till past waking up. I think one of the tricks you mentioned as well too is trying to wake up without an alarm clock. And I tell people one of the best ways to do that is to start in training your sleep and wake times. I mean, if I go to sleep at about the exact same time every night, I'll wake up at the exact same time and I'll sleep almost the same amount every night. I usually sleep about 7 hours and 23 minutes, based off of my sleep trackers, like, BioStrap and Oura Ring, which they're pretty comparable in their numbers. So I'll go to sleep about 9:30. I'll wake up about 6:24. It's crazy. And waking up without an alarm clock, you don't get that big spike in cortisol and disturbance and knock you out of a REM sleep sequence. So you just wake up when you wake up. I tend to wake up more with temperature as well. I have bed cooling systems, so I'll program them to keep me cool throughout the night and then to dial it up as the morning is starting to increase body temperature. And then I also have, I've got all kinds of crazy tricks, but I've got blackout curtains connected to a motorized little gadget that will actually open the curtains during sunrise. So the sun will start coming in. I don't even have to get up and open the curtains. So I'm lazy, but I'd rather do that than get a light bulb that starts to shine, light in my face. So the combination of all that will get my morning going. If I can get a meditation quickly in, I'll do that. I've also got infrared sauna and an ice plunge as well. If it's a weekend, I'll do those in the morning, do like a 30-minute sauna session and then jump in the plunge. It's just the extreme version of hot cold showers. But during the week, it's a little tough to get all that in. I'll do the bulletproof coffee and out the door.
Nice. You have to be in the office pretty early though, don't you?
Yeah, there's days where I'm here pretty early. So yeah, I'm usually out of the house by 7:30.
Yeah. So I just want to also let you know that my normal morning routine while I was working all these crazy hours and jobs and everything, the typical one was like wake up from an alarm, jump out of bed, kind of in a panic, hurry up and get ready, hop on email, and then start the day right away. And while I'm making my coffee and trying to get out the door into the office.
And that's what I'm saying, majority of people out there, wake up, turn your phone on, your texts start coming in, emails come in, stress levels go up, and then, go through a drive-through, pick up some breakfast and stuff it down your face while you're heading to work and sitting in traffic.
Yeah. One thing I have changed. So you're in LA, so you know this very well, but also Atlanta has the most horrific traffic ever. And I say it's comparable to LA just because the roads out here are like spaghetti. They make no sense. They just go round and round and they're horrible. But when I first moved here about 6 years ago, I moved out here to work for CDC, and I was shocked by the traffic. And it was putting me in like a horrible headspace every day because I would just get so angry and upset, like driving to work, trying to get to work on time, and driving only less than 10 miles to work. And it would take sometimes upwards of an hour and a half to go less than 10 miles. It's crazy.
I'm familiar with that. Yeah, I know all that. Yeah.
LA is like terrible. But finally, I let go of like my need for control to like make people drive right and go with the flow. So I started listening to podcasts in the car instead of just radio or music. And then I changed my mind about it. And I said, actually, I am so grateful that I have time to listen to a full episode of my favorite podcast while I'm driving. And once I made that change in my perspective, I actually looked forward to getting into the car and, you know, my cortisol levels wouldn't spike and my heart rate wouldn't go up and I wouldn't get all anxious. And now I actually enjoy that time.
Yeah, that's funny. A lot of people ask me the same. They go, how do you learn all this stuff? And I've got 5 offices in LA and I'm on the road all the time. And, you know, my commutes can be 1 to 2 hours each way sometimes. If I'm working in Orange County, it's like 3.5 hours I'm in the car. So what am I going to do with that time? Am I going to listen to a bunch of nonsense radio music? Am I going to listen to a bunch of highly opinionated news programs about all the death and destruction and viruses, which we'll talk about coronavirus. Since you mentioned CDC, we're going to talk about coronavirus, or celebrity gossip. I don't want to hear any of that. For me, I want to improve and take advantage of the situation. So I call it Road University. And I'll just sit there and I'll learn all these different things and I'll bring them home and share them with the family or with patients or friends, all kinds of tips, tricks, tactics, hacks, whatever you want to call them. I was telling a patient yesterday and he goes, oh, so you're a Rhodes Scholar. I go, that's funny. Yeah.
I love that. That's awesome. So I know the listeners heard, at least on the BioCares podcast, they heard a little bit about your background, but can you just briefly talk about what you do with your patients and what your clinics offer?
Yeah. So my day job, you could call, is a doctor that's treating patients for what's called sleep disordered breathing. So this is going to be people who snore, who have sleep apnea, difficulty with sleep issues. And what I do is I give them what's called a sleep study. And traditional sleep studies are things that you have to do in a lab or in a hospital where you go and you spend the night and they wire you up. So we offer one-stop shop solutions. So we have portable sleep studies, which are newer technology. You just take it home. It'll measure your sleep. It's called a PSG, which is the in-lab one, which is a polysomnogram, and then the HST, which is a home sleep study. And what will happen is we'll get a report generated that'll show the whole sleep characteristics, things like how many hours they slept, how many times per hour they stopped breathing, which could be, I mean, I've had patients over 100 times an hour stop breathing, and normal is 0 to 4. So you'll see oxygen levels, heart rate levels. And what we'll do is we'll sit down, we'll go through the report with them, and then we'll come up with a therapy option, whether it's something called a CPAP machine or a dental device that you can wear in your mouth at night, or a laser treatment, which is kind of a newer, more on the biohacking world, where I use a laser in people's throats inside their mouth and hit all the tissue in the back of your throat that's vibrating at night and causing the snoring and the apnea. And actually the laser will tighten the tissue and cause what's called neocollagenesis, or new collagen and matrix formation. So you have much more rigid, younger, stronger airway, less prone to collapse, which is really, really cool. It's kind of like red light therapy for your, or you know, photobiomodulation for your airway.
That is awesome. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I wanted to learn more about that. I think so many of us, what do you think the percentage is of people who either snore, have sleep apnea, or some sort of breathing issue while they're sleeping?
Yeah. I mean, estimates around 90 to 100 million Americans in US have a snoring issue, and about half of them have apnea. I think it's probably more than that, but that's kind of the statistics. If you go to a party or, you know, dinner or whatever and ask all the wives there, you know, who's disturbed by their husband snoring, I say half of them are going to raise their hands. I mean, whenever I go anywhere and the people hear what I do, they're like, oh my God, I need to come see you this week. So it's pretty prevalent. It's something that gets worse for people as they get older because we get what's called muscle atrophy. So the tissues and the muscles in the neck and the airway lose strength as we get older. And the other is, as we get older, we tend to put on weight. So those are going to be your two biggest culprits.
So is there a way to keep those tissues strong? Like, can you do exercises where you maybe won't need to do the laser thing?
I mean, there are some fringe exercises you can do. I mean, your best bet is to not put on weight. I tell patients, you know, don't get fat. But if you wanted to do some other things, you can do what's the didgeridoo. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So it's an, you know, it's an Aboriginal instrument, and what that does is it causes what's called circular breathing, where you're able to almost kind of blow in and out at the same time, and that will help increase the tone and the tissues in the airway. So that's one little trick you can try.
That's kind of cool. Okay, yeah. So best sleep biohack, guys, go buy yourself a didgeridoo and learn how to play it.
You know, I haven't done it myself. I think I'm going to do it this year. That might be on the radar just for the heck of it.
Yeah, and then you got to do a podcast episode on it.
The Didgeridoo Sleep Podcast. It's coming. Stay tuned.
Yeah. I actually really like the sound of a didgeridoo, so I would listen to that.
All right. I'm on it. Yes. It almost has kind of that om kind of yoga-y type sound. So yeah.
Yeah. We'll do it.
Let me ask you this one here. If I'm listening to your show, and your show is very focused on health and wellness and all these anti-aging things, but I'm new to all that, and I want to start my journey into like health and wellness, you know, what would be, or what would you say should be my first steps?
So this answer is always my answer, but it's not the popular or fun one, especially because people come to me a lot of times, like my health and wellness coaching clients will come to me thinking, oh, she's a biohacker. She's going to tell me to do all of this really cool, innovative stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I disappoint them a lot of times because, first of all, if your lifestyle, meaning your just day-to-day habits, including sleep, nutrition, exercise, relationships, mindset, you know, just like these regular things that you do every single day that you don't really think that much about, they're just kind of like on autopilot. If you don't have those things at a healthy baseline for you, then I don't care if you buy the Juve Light and the Nano V and the Vibe Plate and the, you know, $500 worth of supplements every month. You could do all of that other stuff, but if you don't have the healthy baseline to start out with, it's going to do you no good whatsoever. So I always start there. And then I say, all right, you know, once we get you to a really healthy baseline where you're feeling good, then we can work on those other kind of like exciting tech things that are going to get you that a little extra 1%.
Okay. I like that. I'm into cars. And I guess a good analogy would be trying to put like, you know, racing gas into like a beat up car. I mean, you want to get your body into like a kind of Ferrari mode where you can then take advantage of all this input you put into it.
Yes. Absolutely. So what would yours be? Like if you have a patient coming in that's just like totally doesn't even know where to start on their health and wellness journey, and maybe sleep is their issue, or maybe it's just general poor health, where's the first place you point them?
I think the first place is got to be mindset, because a lot of people will come in and they'll see me and I'll give them a lot of recommendations and they're like, well, I'm not going to do that and I can't do that and that's not for me and I'm never going to be able to do that. So I don't know if you've heard of what's called the nocebo, but yes. It's like, you know, for people who listen who don't know, like let's say you've got cancer and you go to see your doctor and your doctor says, oh, this cancer is bad, you're going to die in 6 months. Well, guess what's happening? That plants the seed into the patient, and research has shown that those people die faster.
Yep.
So these patients that come in and say, you know, I'm not going to be able to do that. I don't think it's going to work. I don't, you know, well then that's the mindset challenge. So first step, like you said, is you need to recognize if this is something you really want to do and then have that momentum to go forward. Once you get past that hurdle, I think that's one of the biggest problems. And then after that, things get easier because then you're open to suggestions, you're open to growth, mm-hmm. to learning. You know, for me, I'd say the things that I've done in the last 3-4 years, if you would have told me 10 years ago, I'd be like, no way in hell. I'm not going to walk on fire at a Tony Robbins event. I'm not going to jump from a 30-foot platform at the biohacking conference. I'm not going to, you know, trust people and let them, you know, be open and open heart and reach out to all these different influencers and people in this world. You know, that was a step for me. But once I got past that, I mean, lots of doors opened, lots of things happened. You know, I've got to travel throughout the world and meet all kinds of different people. And, you know, this year I'm going deeper into kind of personal development. And obviously the hot topics now are, you know, plant medicine and things like that, which I'm looking into. So it's just getting over that mindset hurdle. And then after that, you're open and receptive. And generally, your intentions are better. And whatever you do is going to be more effective.
Yeah, absolutely. Now you are totally speaking my language. Like this is where I'm focusing on my doctoral research is the subconscious mind. And so that's, you know, where your beliefs, your limiting and the beliefs that help you both exist in that subconscious mind. And I'm sure you've read Dr. Bruce Lipton's work. Mm-hmm. He's a cell biologist. So he's basically like the OG of epigenetics, and he's awesome and part of the reason why I got into this field of work. But basically, your beliefs directly affect your health so much so that your beliefs can change your DNA. And so that's where like the nocebo comes into effect. That's also where placebo comes into effect, which placebo represents 30% of all clinical outcomes. So it's real, it's huge. But another thing that I'm actually studying and being certified in through my PhD program is clinical hypnosis, which the reason why I wanted to study this along with neurofeedback and the neuroscience aspect was because I think that the brain and the subconscious, while they're definitely two different entities, they interact in a really cool way. And I really want to completely understand that so that one, I can biohack it. And two, so that I can change these core beliefs that hold me back in the most efficient, like fast way possible.
Yeah, I'm a fan. Actually, I was a psychobio major back at UCLA a long time ago. And I've always been interested in the whole kind of mind-body relationship as well too. So you're talking my language as well.
Yeah, I love that.
All right, I got a couple more for you and then I think we're good. But you mentioned the CDC retiring. I think, did you time this because of the whole coronavirus thing or what's the deal there and what can people do or not do? Speaking of, you know, belief systems and, you know, oh my God, we're, and that's why I don't watch the news because the news is like, oh my God, we're all screwed. Everyone's going to get the virus. What was that movie, Outbreak? Is that, you know, like this outbreak mentality and I'm like, oh, I don't have time for that.
Well, I mean, so first of all, just terminology, we are in an outbreak, but outbreaks happen all the time. This one is a significant one because it is closer and closer to pandemic level, meaning that it has to meet certain requirements to be a global pandemic. And let me just preface all of this by saying I'm not representing CDC in what I'm saying. However, I'm just going to speak about what I know. So this current outbreak that's happening, it very well may reach pandemic level. In fact, it probably will soon, but it doesn't mean that people need to panic. It also doesn't mean that you're going to get the virus. It means that, first of all, you do need to take some extra precautions to be mindful about your health, to be mindful about your behaviors in, you know, a public setting where there could be sick people. And also, mostly, what you're most at risk for right now is flu, because it is flu season. And so what like CDC and World Health Organization and all of these other big global health organizations, what they've been preparing for like, I don't know, 30, 40 years has been pandemic flu. We knew this was going to happen. And so coronavirus is similar to flu. And so all of that planning will go into effect for coronavirus. So that is the really good news, is we are prepared for it. The only thing that is kind of like the X factor, which for me as a health scientist, I'm like watching this in awe, like, oh my gosh, this is so cool, because we're seeing, you know, what we've been preparing for a long time and seeing the science evolve and learning more about the virus and how it transmits initially from animals to humans. And then now we're seeing sustained human to human transmission, which, you know, sounds not exciting. But for me as a health scientist, like watching this play out, I'm like fascinated by it. And I know enough to where I'm not scared because I know what to do. But I think people should, number one, stay informed, but only from trustworthy sources. If you are not getting your coronavirus information from either the CDC website or the World Health Organization website, it is fake news.
You, okay? You mean I should stop checking TMZ for my coronavirus? Okay.
Yeah. So people will forward me like all day long, just because they know that I worked at CDC. They'll forward me all of these articles from like NBC and CNN and Fox News and blah, 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 where people think that these are trustworthy places to get information. And they're so hyped up. And I'm like, okay, I'm not even going to look at this. I'm going to reply to you by sending you back the coronavirus site that has all the updated information. They update it multiple times per day with case counts, with all the information. And plus, if you know, we do get into a pandemic situation, we start to put into place those pandemic flu plans for coronavirus, then the information on where to go to get treatment, how to monitor your symptoms, where to go to get the vaccine when it's available, all of that information is going to be there first and how to go about that so that we don't have just like disorder and disarray, like people just, you know, bombarding hospitals, which will overload the system and be a big problem. So we need people to, in an orderly, calm manner, follow the plans that are in place and everything is going to be fine.
Everything is going to be fine. What are your thoughts on flu shots?
They're a good idea, especially for anyone who is immune compromised, like little kids and older folks, anyone who's in the hospital where your chances of getting flu are really high. Definitely a good idea. For a normal, healthy person, I don't think it's necessary. And one of the reasons why is because typically every year they make a new batch of the flu vaccine, but it's based on the what types of flu were prevalent the year before and the modeling so that they can guess what strains of the flu virus are going to be popular this year. So it's kind of the vaccines, they have to be made in advance and they can't just be made right away. And so a lot of times the strains that are in the current flu shot is not the one that is circulating. So it may have some immune boosting effects, but a lot of times it's kind of hit or miss whether it will protect you from the current flu virus that's circulating.
I like that. Yeah, I haven't been a fan of flu shots. And my take on it is if you are healthy and you're doing all the right things, your immune system should be up to speed to handle it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't usually get the flu shot unless, you know, when I was traveling a lot and I was traveling in Asia and Africa for work, I would get the flu shot at that point just because I had to for travel reasons for work. But yeah.
All right. I got another one unless you want to go, if you got a question.
Yeah. So we talked about our sleep biohacks, but I was wondering if you have suggestions for folks for sleep hygiene. Like I'm talking about your bed, the setting in your room. We talked about dark, cool places, but are there other things that you can do? Like are there specific pillows that are better for good sleep or different types of bedding? Or like, should you sleep in a separate bed from your partner because they're going to wake you up or things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I guess it's just levels of depth of how far you want to take these things. First ones being obviously cool room, dark room. Those are eye shades, right? Those are just some simple ones. If you want to take it a step further, what I do is I have bed cooling systems in my bed, things like Chili Pad or Bed Jet. I've got both. One's a cooling water underneath and the other is ventilated sheet connected to a little fan that blows air, which tends to wick away sweat. That helps me sleep deeper, longer, less waking up. Pillows. I actually just did an interview with New York Magazine on pillows. Mm. And my recommendation is find one that's going to let you sleep on your side the most comfortably, both from an airway perspective. And then I think it just lets the brain detox and flush. And from a circulatory perspective, your left side is going to be the most optimal side. That's what they tell pregnant moms. It's also the best side to prevent reflux as well too. So for people who are struggling with that, sleeping on your side is going to help there. You can also sleep with an inclined bed, like 3 to 4 degrees, where the head of the bed is a little bit higher than the base. Again, for brain flushing, that tends to help. As far as bedding goes, what I have are grounding sheets in my bed now, which are impregnated with silver thread. And then that gets plugged into the ground on the wall. And I've measured it with a voltmeter. And as soon as I touch my pillowcase or my fitted sheet, you know, my body voltage goes to 0.001. So I'm essentially earthing or grounding the entire night. So those are some other fringe, I guess, hacks you could do. Sleeping with your partner, your spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, whatever. Generally, you know, I think it's a good thing unless they're snoring or, you know, getting up and using the bathroom multiple times because that's going to take away from your sleep. In fact, in my industry, I call it secondhand snoring, where like if you have a partner that's snoring, on average, you know, studies have shown you will lose an hour of sleep a night just listening to them. And I tell people, it's like, what if I just, you know, lit up a cigarette and blew it in your face in the middle of the night? You know, that's A, not cool, and B, is going to hurt you. So, you know, obviously eliminating distracting factors, you know, I don't mind, you know, sleeping away from my wife sometimes. Sometimes I get better sleep. Don't tell her that, but I do. So these are the kinds of things you can do as well. One of the biggest ones that I've been playing with lately, which has been really cool, and this is brand new, I haven't talked about this one, is I have an infrared sauna at home that I just got recently. And it's a game changer on lots of levels, but I've been doing it lately at night, kind of close to bedtime. And what'll happen is I'll do a 30-minute session. I'll sweat like crazy. I'll drink some water, but I won't drink as much water as I'm always going to kind of underestimate the water. And what that does is it puts me in a little bit more of a dehydrated state. So when I sleep at night, less chance of me getting up and having to use the restroom as well too. So people who say they get up and have to use the bathroom generally still have too much water in their body. So this is kind of a new hack that I'm playing with as well too. But that gets a little bit more fringe. But just the other stuff that I mentioned should help you sleep better.
Cool. I do maybe half of those, but I have noticed. So I track my sleep with the BioStrap. You had mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, Samir is awesome. He's here in LA. We hang out all the time.
Oh yeah, Samir, he's amazing. I hung out with him the last time I was out in LA, but yeah, he's one of my favorite people. With the BioStrap, the thing I like about it the best is the sleep lab that they have, which not only tracks all the things that like other wearables like Oura Ring or I think Fitbit does most of it now too, is that it gives you your nocturnal HRV, which also Oura Ring does, but it tells you about your other habits and how those things correlate to better sleep. So for instance, on BioStrap, it'll say like something like when you have X amount more active hours throughout the day, your sleep is X percent better. So it can tell you things like what you're saying with your sauna. It can say, you know, I guess if you put in that input, then you could say like your infrared sauna is making your sleep X percent better based on your data. But I'm a big proponent for anyone to start, measure your sleep in some way with some wearable. Otherwise, you don't really know if you're making a lot of progress.
Yeah, and that would be one of the biggest recommendations I would tell people. It's fundamentally, if you want to hack it, you got to track it. And what happens is when you get that information, you can then customize or tailor your routines or optimize them. Because I know like if I eat late or if I have a couple glasses of wine, I know my scores are going to take a tank, you know, they're going to tank because, you know, I've been wearing trackers for years now, multiple trackers. So I don't need to wear them anymore at this point just because I've gotten so in tune. I know when I wake up generally within a few points what my score is going to be, but that's because I've become entrained. It's almost like it's a biofeedback type thing. So if you do want to kind of go down this road, is like you said, you know, get a BioStrap. The cool thing with the BioStrap too is that it has pulse oximetry. So yeah. I don't know if you saw that. So that means it'll measure your oxygen levels at night. And again, in this world that I treat patients who stop breathing or have poor breathing at night, you'll see these numbers plummet. I mean, I'll go down into the 50%.
Whoa.
Which is crazy. Yeah, these people need to be in like the hospital.
That's insane. Yeah. So when you're looking at somebody, I'm just curious, when you're looking at somebody who stops breathing at night, like how long can a person actually stop breathing without dying? Like how long are they not breathing?
So here's the way I could put it. You know what a pulse oximeter is, right? Those little like red laser things you put on your finger. If you were to put one on your finger and breathe, it should be about 97%, 98, 99, something like that. If I were to tell you to put it on your finger and hold your breath for as long as you can, you're going to go down to maybe 90%, maybe high 80s, and that's it. You could turn blue in the face. Now, for these people who sleep at night who have issues, they're going down to the 70, 60, 50%. So you have to be thinking, what amount of failure is going on in their breathing at night to let their oxygen drop that far down if you can't do that, if you can't drop 10% while you're awake? So these people are stopping breathing 60, 90, you know, I've seen 2 minutes, which is just insane. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on a systemic level, that's going to cause all kinds of things as far as muscle atrophy. It's going to cause brain impairment, even like brain cell death. Gosh, I can't even imagine what type of long-term effects. If that's happening every single night for compounded over, you know, 20 years, what kind of damage is that doing?
So the two biggest things is 3 times likelihood of a heart attack, 4 times likelihood of a stroke. All these patients are going to be on blood pressure medications. They're going to be type 2 diabetic, you know, weight gain, mood disorders, depression, libido. I mean, I get guys all the time saying, you know, they've got issues with their plumbing now. And I go, that's terrible. So, you know, you don't want to go down that road. And it's more complicated than just stopping breathing. It's a whole lifestyle disease where it takes more than just what we do here to really get to the root of it. Because I could put you on a CPAP machine, but that doesn't mean you can keep hitting the buffets and going to the fast food chains. It's like, if you really want to focus at it, you got to do something above and beyond.
Yeah. And you know what? I actually see that same mentality in the biohacking world, and it makes me a little sad, is there, everybody's looking for, you know, that quick fix. And a lot of these technologies, while they're cool and awesome and amazing, sometimes they allow people to have an excuse not to do the work so that they can just skip over it and then buy this piece of technology that they think is going to fix all their problems while they're still going to Taco Bell and they're still not really sleeping and they're still like in a toxic relationship and they're still using all these chemicals in their home. But, you know, they got that one tech. And so
they got that really cool Instagram picture of them sitting in some expensive machine.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of a double-edged sword because I love all that stuff. It's super cool. The science is growing and it's amazing to see what we can do with technology. I'm all about biotech. But if we don't get these basic fundamental health and wellness principles under control first, then I don't think we should be even touching that other stuff.
All right. So I got one more for you here. What is something that people think is good for them, but it might actually not be?
I think dieting in general is my biggest pet peeve, even if it is I'm putting in air quotes, healthy diet. So people will go on these extreme diets, whether it be keto or vegan or whatever. And I'm not against any of those things. However, they go so extreme from what they were initially doing. So let's say you're just eating a general American diet, and then you all of a sudden switch on to traditional keto, which is very, very restrictive. Traditional keto is less than, I think, 50 grams of carbs per day. Uh-huh. And then they find out, you know, after a couple of months, they're super stressed out and they put all this pressure on themselves and they weren't able to sustain it. And then they're feeling bad because they relapsed or whatever. I think it's more damaging to go from 0 to 60 with diets and make a radical change if, you know, it's really not going to be sustainable for you. And if it's going to cause you more stress because you're just so obsessive about what you're eating, then I think it's going to do the opposite of helping you. And I guess that's the same with any sort of crazy lifestyle change where you get obsessive. It's, you know, the term now going around is orthorexic, which means that you just get so obsessive about some sort of health behavior, which is supposed to be healthy, but it does the opposite. It makes you kind of neurotic, and then it starts to wear down on your health over time.
I like it.
What about you?
So for me, I was thinking about this, like I watched the Super Bowl, and I don't really watch a lot of football at all. Actually, I don't watch any, but I just watched the Super Bowl just for the heck of it. And I would say just about every commercial break had a 5G ad.
Yeah.
You know, oh my God, we're plastering the US. Get ready. Here it comes. And for me, you know, people are like, oh my God, I can't wait. I need to get the, you know. So I would say EMFs, maybe not people thinking it's good for them, but maybe just people not realizing that there could be potential damage and people just get excited. Oh, my Netflix is going to be blazing fast. I can't wait. You know, so Dr. Mercola just released his book EMF'd, and I haven't gotten it yet, but I've already listened to a few shows regarding it. I'm aware of all the cell phone towers. Here's the thing with, like, talk about Bruce Lipton. I mean, I listen to some like Luke Story podcasts and he'll talk about cell phones and towers and all this. And I drive around LA, and for a while I was spotting them out and looking at them and, like, you know, getting nervous as I drove by them. And my kids are like, look, there's an explosion tower right there. And I'm like, oh no. So then I'm like, okay, I gotta, you know, just relax, take a deep breath. You know, they're there, but if I give them more attention, they're going to, you know, put more influence on me. So I think it's a fine line, but I think it should be at least open to the idea that maybe it might not be a good idea to have all these different crazy levels of millimeter waves and stuff blasting everywhere. But, you know, the media wants to say it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a middle ground, but with everything, what my mentality is I cannot control a lot of things outside of myself. So what can I do about this? Either I can sit here and freak out and be angry and, you know, about 5G, which there's nothing I can do. Like Atlanta is rolling out 5G, whether or not I'm happy or sad about it. So that's happening no matter what, but I have a choice about how I want to react. So I put my Wi-Fi on a timer. It goes off at night. So when I'm sleeping, my Wi-Fi is not just radiating. You know, I do little things. I put my phone in airplane mode when I stick it in my pocket. When I sleep, I turn it off or put it on airplane mode. Just doing little things that I can do to protect myself, even though I can't change the big, you know, movements that are being made in 5G and whatever. I also don't obsess over it because there's nothing I can do about the cell tower that's, you know, 50 feet from my house. Like I can't take it down. And I own this house. So I can't do anything about that. What I can do are make little changes to protect myself and also not get so obsessive about it that it's harming my health because I'm so stressed out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we grow what we give attention to. So I just kind of at this point, because I know there's a lot of people out there that are either super excited about it or they're super, you know, kind of fear mongering, like, you know, it's the end of the world. So, you know, pick your poison.
I'm kind of neutral about it. Yeah. I don't talk about it a lot because I think there's a little too much fear mongering. I don't really want to add to that. However, I'm personally informed of the risks and I do what I can to protect myself personally.
Excellent. So, yeah, I mean, I got lots of stuff that I wanted to get out of you. So is there anything else you wanted to go over?
Yeah. So I have just one more question for you that I actually like to ask all of my podcast guests.
Cool.
Maybe it's something we talked about today, or maybe it's something totally different. But if you could just provide one piece of tangible health and wellness advice to the listeners of our podcast that would have the greatest benefit on their health, what would that be?
Oh boy. You know what? I kind of can't put it into one. I would put it into three if that's okay.
Yeah.
My three biggest pillars of health are going to be nutrition, it's going to be movement, and it's going to be sleep. So whatever you can do to optimize those three, that's what's going to give you the biggest bang for the buck. Nutrition, like you said, doesn't have to be crazy keto, paleo, vegan, kosher, whatever diet. It just needs to be paying attention to what you put in and what you get out. Movement doesn't have to be Ironman, triathlons. It literally could be just going for a walk for 30 minutes in the day in the park, maybe even with barefoot on grass. I mean, it could be that simple. And then sleep could be, you know, just a matter of, you know, trying to go to sleep and wake up at the same time. I mean, very, very simple stuff. So focusing on those three, because when those are out of whack, you get inflammation. And if you get inflammation over a long enough time, you get disease. So for me, I've seen that progression happen to my dad, where his lifestyle choices weren't the best. His sleep wasn't the best. You know, all the things were not optimized. And now, you know, he's in an Alzheimer's facility and he doesn't recognize me. So that's been a challenge last couple of years dealing with that. So for me, whatever I can do to not go down that road, just because I don't want to be personally in it, and then I don't want to put the burden on my family to then have to provide care for me at that time, that's what motivates me to do what I do.
Yeah. I'm sorry that you're going through that with your dad. I have some family members that have had that as well, and it's the most terrible thing. So I think absolutely, I 100% agree with you. Invest in your health now. You know what? I actually heard something really interesting that I may mention about that. So there's a study going on and I forget who's running it, but our brains are very self-focused. So our brains, our prefrontal cortex lights up when we speak about ourselves or when somebody speaks about us to us. So we're very selfish how we're wired in our brains. And so that's why the whole psychology about talking to somebody about what's in it for them is the best way to sell something or whatever, because you're talking about them and it's lighting up their brain and it's releasing dopamine and oxytocin and all the good chemicals that make them feel really good when you talk about them to them. And your brain does the same thing if you think about yourself, obviously in a positive way. But your brain actually associates your future self as a totally different person. So if you think about yourself now, your prefrontal cortex lights up, you get all excited, you feel good. If you think about yourself in the future, your brain doesn't identify that as you. So that whole part shuts off and you kind of get bored and turn off your attention. So it's really interesting because when we make investments in our future health, this is why it's so hard to make little changes in daily habits now that are going to pay off later, because our brain does not see our future self as us. So it's going to benefit a different person. So then it doesn't, your brain is not hardwired to help you make these changes. So we have to be a little bit more diligent, but also I want people to know it's okay that it's hard to make those daily changes because our brain is literally wired to make it hard for us.
That's an interesting point. I like that. And, you know, I haven't really thought too deep on that, but yeah, I see where you're going, where we kind of disassociate between our future self and the present self. And then don't even get me started on the whole, you know, mindfulness and being in the present and not dwelling in the past and the future, because that's a whole different podcast right there too.
Totally. I mean, we could totally do a podcast just on mindset and mindfulness, but we won't go down that rabbit hole today.
We'll save that one for next time.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for this conversation. It was awesome. And it's definitely setting me up for a great day today.
Yeah, it's early day for me here as well. Kayla, thank you so much. I think this has been a blast. I definitely want to do more of these in the future. It's just kind of a double header is always very cool. Yeah. Lots of information, hopefully for both your listeners and mine. So I can't wait to get this thing out there and do it again.
Awesome. Thank you.
And that's a wrap, folks. I hope you had as much fun as we did. And if you have any questions or thoughts or feedback on the things we talk about, you can reach me on my Instagram account at sleepbiohacker. That's where I tend to hang out when I'm not in my practice treating my patients. And if you enjoy these shows, please leave me a quick review on wherever you get your podcast to help spread the word and help me continue to get these awesome guests. And thank you for making it all the way to the end. I really do appreciate your support. And I hope you have the best night ever.
This broadcast is for informational purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this show are not medical advice. The show, including Dr. Jay Corsandi, the co-host, guest, and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of any information contained herein. Opinions of the guests are their own. We do not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests, nor do we make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. If you think you have a medical problem, please consult a licensed physician.